The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
This week on Where Did the Road Go, we welcome back David Weatherly. Are you with us, Dave?
I am. Good evening.
And we had you on last time for your book, The Black Eyed Children. You've now followed that up with a book entitled Strange Intruders. And it does include a little bit of The Black Eyed Children. And did you start writing this like as soon as the other book was done?
Sort of. Some of the material, you know, obviously came from cases I had worked on over the last several years or more. And it was sort of a follow-up in that it encompassed entity encounters in a broader scope. And, you know, I wanted to convey to people that these weird beings have been around for a very long time. So I sort of tried to blend in some historical cases like the Spring Hill Jack case and things like that, along with very contemporary things, and just address some of the questions that people have consistently asked me about a lot over the last couple of years, and address some of the topic areas that I constantly hear about.
Well, you have the black-eyed children in here, but you kind of expand on it to black-eyed adults and even a black-eyed toddler at one point. Since you wrote the last book, have you seen any different patterns emerge with these black-eyed individuals?
Only slight variations. You know, probably the two most common questions I receive about the black-eyed children are, one, are there cases of people inviting them inside? And two, are there reports of black-eyed adults? Well, when I did the initial research for the Black-Eyed Children book, I did come across some cases of encounters with black-eyed adults. The issue is you get into a place where there's a lot of potential for, you know, hoaxing and things like that. And some of the cases, a lot of the cases, I absolutely ruled out because of that. But then you start to see some of these, you know, it's a small percentage of these very weird encounters where people are very sincere. And there are elements that sort of reflect from the black-eyed kid encounters into these black-eyed adult encounters. And, you know, more and more, not just me, but other paranormal investigators are getting these reports of black-eyed adults that behave in a very strange manner, you know, a little bit different than the black-eyed children. But it starts to give you, it brings to mind the question, you know, if these things have existed for a long time, well, you know, maybe some of them have grown into adulthood and are still sort of existing here among us, and what exactly are they up to? So I tried to address that a little bit in the book, and included a couple of very interesting black-eyed kid encounters that I had received since the initial book came out, and also looked at some of the black-eyed adult cases. And we're starting to see more encounters that sort of blend the two. You know, even since my new book has come out, I've received a couple of accounts of people witnessing a black-eyed, you know, man with a black-eyed child, you know, accompanying him. So it's very curious. We still have a lot of questions about it, obviously, but the number of these encounters is growing at a ridiculous rate. I'm familiar with several other investigators around the country and abroad that are getting these accounts, just like I am, on a daily basis. And they're all different accounts. So something's going on.
Would you like to relate one of these newer stories that you've gotten in that's not in the book?
You know, not at this point, because they're very recent and I'm still following up and interviewing people. So maybe I'll come back on at some point and fill you in on the details of those. But I like to have a real firm grasp of all the facts and explore the possibilities and see what's really going on before I really reveal those too much. But I can sort of whet the appetite in that there was an encounter recently in Virginia with some people that encountered a man, they thought in his 30s, with solid black eyes, and a young boy was with him about 10 years old, and he also had solid black eyes. So it's starting to really raise some different questions as to exactly what's going on with these accounts.
How do you go about trying to figure out whether people are hoaxing you or not?
You know, after being in this field so many years, it really honestly doesn't take too long for the most part to determine when someone's being honest. And there are a lot of common signs that you look for. You know, whether it's a black eyed child case or a haunted investigation or a UFO sighting, regardless of what it is, most seasoned investigators can pretty much spot fairly quickly, some red flags. And I won't go into all the kind of boring details, but for instance, one of them, you know, this is very common with haunted cases. You know, if you get a call and someone's reporting seeing an apparition or, you know, having a haunted location or something like that, and when you sit down and start interviewing these people and you find out that one of the early questions is, do you think this show will be on, this story will be on television? You know, that sadly there's a lot of people that are just looking for their 15 minutes of fame, and they think that the paranormal is an easy way to accomplish that. Other occasions, you know, and more often than not, it's not people intentionally trying to hoax you. It's a case of people, you know, not understanding natural phenomena or circumstances that are going on in their home. You know, the paranormal has become such a part of pop culture that people are more apt to jump to conclusions a lot of the times now. And, you know, on the other side of the spectrum, and this is kind of a sadder aspect of the paranormal, we have a lot of people out there proclaiming themselves investigators and experts who honestly don't know what they're doing. And, you know, they'll go into a location and they'll scare people. I can't tell you how many calls I've gotten from people who say, oh, you know, the paranormal team was here and they told me I have a demon infestation. And, you know, it's kind of funny on the one hand, but you have to understand this is a serious matter. These are people who are sincerely looking for answers. And a lot of times these teams are going in and they're terrifying these people. And the team leaves, you know, so they can go post another investigation on their website, and they, you know, they're not worried about what the person is experiencing or what they're dealing with from having been told, hey, you got a, you know, a pack of demons running around your house. And so, you know, some of the things I've seen are just despicable. And I'm sorry?
No, I'm sorry, I coughed.
And, you know, some of it's despicable and some of it is just a result of ignorance and again, people jumping to conclusions. You know, I'll give you a perfect example of something like this. I was called by a woman who was referred to me, and she was incredibly distraught. She firmly believed that she had demonic activity in her home. And, you know, this paranormal team had come in, and they had investigated, and you know, they showed her this evidence, and, you know, they essentially just left her to fend for herself. And she had children, and she was, you know, having an incredibly difficult time trying to figure out what to do and come to terms with this. And I ended up going to the location and meeting with this woman, and, you know, when I started to really sit down and look at the so-called evidence and the facts and so forth, you know, it was pretty disturbing what these people had portrayed as demonic activity. And, you know, two of the things that were very significant that they pushed at her was that there were she was hearing these noises in the home, and they actually recorded the noises, and they told her that it was a demon that was scratching at the portal to get into the home. The other thing they found was that the number 666 had supposedly materialized on the wall of her child's bedroom. So, you know, really looking at this evidence, when I went into this child's room and started to inspect these things, it wasn't that difficult to see that the landlord who had rented this house to this woman had essentially done a very cheap paint job on the home and sort of whitewashed the walls. Well, apparently the room that her child was in had been a child's room previously, and the previous child had taken crayon and scrawled all over the wall. And, I asked this woman's permission. I said, can I remove some of this paint? I want to show you what's going on here. And so I took some cleaner and started scrubbing the wall down, and the 666 was merely part of the swirl pattern that went all the way across the entire wall. It was written in crayon from the child that had previously been in the room, and there were all kinds of other, scrawls on the wall also. So that sort of shot down the 666 manifestation. And, when I contacted an exterminator and had them come out, the scratching in the walls proved to be rats, not a demon trying to get in a portal. So, this woman, she went through just this month of hell, no pun intended, by believing that there was some type of demonic activity in her home. So, simply investigating the facts a little bit more closely and then suggesting that she, call her clergy and have them come in just to do a cleansing, has a psychological benefit of making her feel better, sort of resolved the whole case. So, I find, getting back to the original question, I find that they're really, the skeptics like to portray that there are, tens of thousands of people running around trying to perpetrate hoaxes on the paranormal field. And I just don't think that there are that many. Yeah, they come and go, but, it's not as extreme as it seems to some people.
Well, I would think the plethora of paranormal TV shows has probably added both to the hoaxing and to people thinking that's what's going on in their home when it's not.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it sure has. The popularity of the paranormal television show is kind of a blessing and a curse for people, in the field that have been investigating for a long time, because, I find that on the one hand, there's a lot more, mistakes and people, hearing a few bumps in the night and being convinced that Grandma Irma's back. And on the other hand, the benefit is that because of it being so acceptable now, people are willing to share their accounts and their real stories. So, some fascinating things have come about as a result of that.
In the book, you talk about some black-eyed people who had perfectly normal eyes at one point, and then they shift to complete black as if there's something hiding inside of them. Have you come across a lot of these type of stories?
Quite a few. It's very curious because when the Black Eyed Children book came out, I really kind of expected to get, quite a few accounts of Black Eyed Children from people, reading the book or hearing me on interviews and so forth. But I was really surprised at the number of accounts that started being sent to me about these situations where there would be, a person whose eyes suddenly completely changed to a different color, usually solid black, occasionally something different. And it's really weird. I don't know exactly where this falls yet. Some people have purported to have seen, humans who appear to be normal, everyday people whose eyes suddenly changed to sort of a reptilian form. And, the whole reptilian field is it's parts of it are really out there. We've got all the David Icke material that's been around for years, and we've got lots of other cases of reptilians and so forth. So it's very curious. A lot of people seem to gravitate towards that whole spectrum of things, and these cases with these humans whose eyes turn suddenly black seems to be along the border of that whole reptilian mythos somehow, because, these people are reporting very similar types of things during the encounters and these weird behaviors. And again, it gives us the sense that, there are some other beings from somewhere else that are possibly living here among us, you know, and have been for a very long time. Some of these accounts are just mind-boggling. There's an account in the book from a couple living in a suburban neighborhood, and you know, all of a sudden they've got new neighbors, and it's just, you know, seems to be a nice, normal couple. And when they start interacting with these people, they start noticing some very odd things. They invite them over to, you know, a cookout or something, and these people won't go anywhere near the grill. You know, they seem like they're afraid of a fire or something. It's chalked up to, well, you know, maybe they just have some kind of phobia of fire or something like that. But as the communications start to develop, some strange things happen. And this this woman who I interviewed about this account, her name was Charlene, and you know, she told me that these people would start coming over to visit, and the woman came over to visit a few times, and she would always sit in the same place, you know, in the kitchen, and just be very stiff and awkward conversation, you know, as if she was trying to understand how to relate. And one day this cat came out of the back room that belonged to Charlene's mother, and this woman just kind of freaked out about this cat, and the cat suddenly was terrified and ran out of the room. And you know, later on, when Charlene and her husband go next door to talk to these people, they witness the couple's eyes shift from just normal human appearing eyes to solid black, and the bizarre behavior just sort of continued. You know, these people would constantly watch outside of the blind, you know, watch through the blinds and watch people walk by. And no one could really figure out what they did. But the strange thing is they suddenly just disappeared. They just weren't living there. And, you know, I had the opportunity to talk to Charlene and other people in the neighborhood. And the curious fact was that no one could remember these people moving in, nor could they remember them moving out. And, you know, this is sort of an average middle class, you know, suburban neighborhood. Most of the people have kids. You know, when you know, someone moves into a neighborhood like that, there's usually moving trucks and a lot of activity, and you know, the same when they move in or out. And none of this was witnessed when these people came and went. And no one could really remember exactly when they moved in. Just as if they were all of a sudden living there. And it's a very bizarre case. And a lot of these accounts that I've been receiving, and a few other people have been receiving them also, of these types of encounters where there's a normal person that's part of their work environment or neighborhood and so forth, and all of a sudden this bizarre behavior is exhibited and the person disappears.
Hmm. There was one you were talking about with a masseuse, and one of the things this black-eyed person had said to her is that I think that was the one where they were saying everything is okay, but there was another one that someone was told they won't remember this or something.
Mm-hmm. And yeah,
and that makes you wonder if there's something there, if that you're not going to remember this takes hold, how many people are having experiences that they simply don't remember?
Exactly. And, you know, these are a few of the common phrases that seem to manifest in these encounters. It's a little bit like the Black Eyed Kid accounts where we hear, you know, very odd phrases that are repeated, you know, numerous times and so forth. And with these accounts of these people whose eyes shift, we're hearing similar things. You know, there's nothing to worry about. You know, you won't remember this. You didn't see anything, or you didn't see what you thought you saw. I was talking to a lady just a couple of days ago, and she was using a lot of very colorful language when she was describing the account to me. But, you know, it was a gentleman in her work environment, and she witnessed this similar type of thing where his eyes completely changed, and he was very startled because of her reaction, and he said, you didn't see what you think you saw. And she had some colorful words for him, too, and stormed out of the room, you know, to get away from him. But, you know, it makes you wonder as you said, exactly what's going on, you know, how many people out there have blocked memories of these types of encounters. We just don't know.
Which also brings to mind the UFO phenomenon, the fact that many people block out memories of that. And it reminds me also, again, of the Men in Black.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. There's consistently, you know, a lot of these different types of phenomena that seem to interrelate somehow. And that's, you know, it's always been my approach to look at strange phenomena in a very holistic manner. That's something I got from some of my early influences, you know, people like John Keel, who, you know, just looked at it as a whole and not isolated phenomena. You know, I think it's great that some people choose to specialize and just, you know, just research UFOs or just research haunted locations and things like that. But, you know, I think it's really important that we look at how all of this phenomena interacts and, you know, why we have situations where there are, you know, a whole wide range of weird phenomena that seems to connect somehow. It's like the Mothman sightings, you know, in Point Pleasant. A lot of people get focused on the Mothman entity itself and forget the fact that, well, there were UFO sightings up there, there were Men in Black encounters, there were a lot of things going on of a very strange nature in that location all around the same time. And this is a very common thing that you find in hot spots like this around the world.
Yeah. One of the stories I really enjoyed in here was the one that you actually experienced, the Grinning Man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Do you want to tell people a little bit about your experience?
Yeah, you know, that it remains one of the weirdest things I've ever seen. It's funny too, because, you know, sometimes the more subtle something is, I think the more disturbing it is somehow.
Yeah,
what happened for me was,
if it's out of place, it doesn't need to be completely
exactly
overblown to creep you out. If it is, it almost just doesn't seem real.
Exactly, yeah. You know, what happened for me was that I was actually riding in a car with a friend of mine in a rural area of North Carolina. And, you know, we were driving along this road. It's just very heavily wooded. You know, it's one of those areas where there's really not room to pull off. You know, you can't really pull your car off in most of those spots. And if you broke down, you would literally be sitting right there in the road. And as we were driving along at a, you know, fairly leisurely pace. And as we started to come to this one area of road, I noticed ahead that there was a man standing on the side of the road, on the right side. And he was sort of standing in the weeds. Something, you know, was just odd. I mean, even from a distance, I thought, this is kind of a weird-looking character. He had on one of those, not a full top hat, but one of the, I forget what they call them, but, you know, it's cut like a top hat, but not quite as big. And you know, had on this coat that looked sort of old-fashioned, and he had one hand up sort of below his chin. And as we approached, I realized he was kind of rubbing his fingers together. I could see that below, underneath this coat was this very shiny belt. And the weirdest thing was that this man had an absurdly large grin on his face. And you know, at the time when I first saw him, what came to mind was the Joker, you know, the Batman villain with this impossibly large grin. And as we passed him, we experienced this moment where everything was just moving in slow motion. And, you know, he followed us with his eyes as we passed. And, you know, I was staring at this man trying to see all the details that I could. And I can't even express how weird that feeling was of everything moving in slow motion. And it's probably only for a few seconds, literally, but, you know, all of a sudden we're past him, and I spun around so that I was looking out the back window. And it, as quickly as I was able to turn my head, The man, this grinning man, had relocated. Now he's standing in the middle of the road, watching our car, you know, drive away. And I'm convinced there's no way a human could have moved like that. But somehow he had just relocated himself. And of course, we continued on, went around this curve, and Tom, my friend who was driving, was rather pale, and I started insisting to him that he stop and turn around, and it was not easy to get him to actually stop the vehicle and turn around, and you know, he was convinced that this was just some kind of a psycho out wandering in the woods or something, and finally, when Tom turned the car around and went back to the spot, this character was gone, and much to Tom's chagrin, I jumped out of the car and went and checked out the location where this guy had been standing. You know, I looked in the road to see if there was any physical evidence. I looked on the side portion where he had been standing, and really, you know, couldn't find anything. There was no sign of him anywhere. And again, this is, you know, a very dense area. There's not anywhere he could have escaped to. So it was a very bizarre encounter. You know, years later, I was able to talk to John Keel, as a matter of fact, about it, because he had labeled a character, the Grinning Man, during a case that he investigated, and had actually found a number of similar cases around the country of people reporting these odd characters with these impossibly large grins and strange appearances. You know, sometimes they'd wear bright shirts and things like that. It was a very strange thing. There was UFO activity that showed up in the aftermath of our encounter with the Grinning Man. I found out much later that there were, in fact, a number of UFO sightings in the area, and it seems that these Grinning Man cases usually accompany UFO activity when they show up.
Which seems to go for a lot of this stuff.
Exactly.
And I don't think it means it's alien necessarily, because I'm not sure that UFOs are extraterrestrial per se. I think whatever's causing them is perhaps, this is just another aspect of that same phenomena.
Yeah, I think that's the case. I'm not a big, I don't really support the hypothesis that, you know, there's spaceships coming from Zeta Reticuli or whatever, flying through space and coming here to visit us. I go more towards the dimensional portal concept that, you know, things are coming through into our world from some type of portal. And I think that's supported by a lot of cultural beliefs from around the world. You know, this concept that, and I talked about this a little bit in the book, but if you go to native cultures around the world, you'll find this whole, this very similar concept that there were races of beings that lived here with us for a time and that they left. And, you know, most of those accounts, they don't talk about them getting into to physical spaceships necessarily and flying away. A lot of times the accounts will say, you know, the beings left through a shimmering portal or, you know, a hole in the mountain or the earth and things like that. So I think we're looking at some type of dimensional opening that these beings, whatever they are, know how to operate. And it's fascinating to me that science is now, you know, quantum science is now coming around to that same concept. A few years ago, there was a lot in the media about quantum scientists having determined that there were other dimensions of existence, you know, and I forget what the number is, like 12 or something. But, you know, these theoretical Einstein had come out and said, okay, we figured out there are 12 other dimensions of existence. We don't know how to get to them, but we know they're there. Well, you know, just because we can't get there doesn't mean something there can't get here.
True. And it may be that what we're seeing is something we can't actually put a genuine face on, so our minds are creating a cover for it that we can understand.
Oh, sure. And, you know, we get into cultural concepts of, you know, perception. And people don't always account for that, but, you know, when you're conditioned to recognize certain things, and it's so much a part of our consciousness and our subconsciousness, you know, like the gray aliens, you know, it becomes such a meme that it's very possible that people are experiencing some kind of a weird phenomena or something, and the only way their brain can comprehend it is to pull that image of, you know, those little gray aliens entering into the picture.
Right, and that's something that they also said became more common once the gray alien became a part of more common culture, whereas they existed before. They weren't as consistent as they are today, before like Communion and Missing Time and books like that came out. So it seems like it might have created something for us to cover this phenomenon with.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, a lot of people don't realize that that physical image has actually been around for a very long time. There are, you know, native stories here and there that sound very close to those descriptions. You know, H.G. Wells, when he wrote First Man on the Moon in 1901, he described this race of beings, and I believe they're called the Selenites, that essentially, you know, they sound like the gray aliens. There are these things that have grayish skin, oversized heads, and these large black eyes. Well, what, you know, in modern times, what does that remind us of?
Right.
You know, in 87, when Whitley Strieber released Communion, you know, that cover of, you know, the face of that gray alien staring forward, I think that that created an entirely new wave of people recognizing and identifying aliens as that image. And that's a very iconic image at this point. And it's just locked into so many people's consciousness that, you know, that's the common, you know, if you say alien to just about anyone now, that's the image that
right.
99% of the time people are going to think of.
All right. Well, we got to take a quick break. The book is Strange Intruders by David Weatherly. Where can people get the book?
LeprechaunPress.com.
Okay. And it's not on Amazon?
It's not on Amazon at this point, no.
Okay, is it going to be at any point?
Probably, yes.
Oh, okay. All right. And your website for people to check out?
Yeah, that is twocrowsparanormal.blogspot.com. That is T-W-O-C-R-O-W-S, paranormal.blogspot.com. You'll see coverage of events I'm doing and different articles that I post on there. There's a batch from my Facebook and other information, and you can link to get the book from there too.
Alright, we'll be back in a minute with David Weatherly.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, links section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
All right, we are talking to David Weatherly on tonight's Where Did the Road Go? And, David, you're going to be at the Paradigm Symposium in a couple of weeks, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I had the pleasure of speaking there last year. That was the first year of the Paradigm Symposium. It was a huge success. And it's returned this year to Minneapolis, Minnesota. And, you know, the lineup of people is just amazing. Scott Walter from America Unearthed. My good friend L.A. Marzulli, who's written all the books on the Nephilim. Robert Bavall, the Egyptologist, Nick Redfern is going to be there, another good friend and an amazing speaker, Reedy Jones. Wow, it's just an amazing list. John Ward from Egypt,
and of course Mike.
You know, it's going to be just an incredible event, and of course it's hosted by Intrepid Magazine, which is Scott Allen Roberts and Micah Hanks, and it's a it's a 4-day event. It starts on Thursday and ends on Sunday, and that's the weekend of the
17th, 18th,
18th and 19th.
Yeah.
So, You know, there are day passes available if you can only make a day. Well worth the trip. Just, you know, you'll find an amazing group of people, and it's really taken the caliber of these events to a very high degree. So it's going to be a great time.
Yeah, it really is one hell of a lineup looking there, and the price isn't particularly bad for what you're getting out of it.
No, it's not, and there's, you know, a lot of other events associated with it. There's a banquet on Saturday night if you want to go to that. There's, you know, cocktail parties, and it's one of those events where there's just a lot of time and a lot of access to the speakers. You know, I do a lot of events, and you know, I usually try to just be available pretty much the whole time I'm there to interact. I'd love to meet people and interact with people. And, you know, some of the events you'll find that the guests aren't that available. You know, they come and do their lecture and that's kind of it, but you won't find that at Paradigm. And these people, you know, you'll find all of us lined up at the bar or out in the common areas and, you know, interacting with people. And it's just a great environment. It really is.
And do you have any idea what you're going to be talking about?
I will be lecturing on tulpas, which is actually the subject of the book I'm close to being finished with now. And it's a pretty fascinating area. The lecture itself is called Tulpas, Thought Forms, and the Web of Life.
Well, you mentioned that a little bit in this book. And do you want to get into the Slender Man now, or do you want to wait?
Yeah, we can talk about the Slender Man.
Yeah, so Slender Man's kind of an oddball in this book.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, it's sort of in there because, simply because there have so many people asked me about it, and despite what I thought was a well-chronicled history online of the Slender Man, there's still a lot of people that don't know exactly what it is. So for those who don't know, the Slender Man is essentially an internet creation. There was a contest on a forum called Something Awful. The forum was called Something Awful. And
right.
The contest, the basis of the contest was that you were supposed to create a paranormal themed creature or being, along with a Photoshop picture or video, and the idea was that you had to convince people it was real, and they wanted to create something that they could make go viral on the internet to convince people. So when the contest initially started, of course, there were a wide range of things being posted, you know, from a lot of cryptid-type creatures and different types of mishmashed beings and UFO-type encounters and all kinds of things. Well, in the midst of it, someone posted this very subtle story. It's back to that subtlety that we were talking about again earlier. And has this thing developed? I'm going to fast forward a little bit because it's kind of involved. But essentially what developed was this being called the Slender Man. The entire thread on the forum became devoted to this creature. And the idea was that the Slender Man was this strange humanoid being that was incredibly thin, virtually no face that was discernible, very long arms, sometimes multiple arms. And he was this creature that sort of lurked in the background, sort of a modern-day boogeyman or creature under the bed who was always there in the shadows waiting to snatch people. And, you know, the subtlety of the early postings on this thing, I think, are what really empowered it. As it developed, other people began to add to the mythos. An internet video series came along called Marble Hornets. And Marble Hornets was this whole series of videos about a student film that was being made. And, you know, the gentleman is producing that disappears, and there are all these subtle implications in each installment about this being that's sort of lurking in the background and possibly took him. And, you know, it played to a lot of people's primal fears, I think. Now, the curious thing about the Slenderman is that people independent of this forum began to report this thing. And, in fact, Coast to Coast AM one night started receiving frantic calls from people convinced that they had had encounters with this thing. As the mythos grew, people, you know, started posting the idea that the Slender Man was a being that had been around for a very long time. You know, they were doing things as creative as altering medieval wood carvings or cuttings, block impressions and so forth, saying that, you know, here's an early depiction of the Slender Man from the medieval period and so forth. But this creation has really, over the last couple of years, taken on sort of a life of its own. And, you know, there are an incredible number of people that are convinced that this thing is actually real. And there are people who are convinced that they have had encounters with this thing that we can document was created on the Internet.
And that might be another example, too, of an unknown phenomena taking a face from something that we can put our minds around a little bit.
I think that's possible. You know, we get into the region too of the tulpa,
right?
The topic I touched on briefly when we start talking about this, because, you know, you essentially have thousands of people putting energy into the existence of something. And, you know, what exactly does that cause? You know, the human mind and the human energy field has capabilities that we just don't fully understand yet at this point. And, you know, when you've got something like this that is presented as a real phenomena, you know, people are going to jump in and say, okay, I believe this, or I've seen this. And, you know, we have to wonder what that co-creates, you know, whether it's merely a construct in their own minds and they really believe they experienced it, or whether they're experiencing a different phenomena that they're perceiving in that form. It's hard to say, but those are both distinct possibilities.
What always comes to mind in stuff like this, though, is I think David Talbot writes about it in The Holographic Universe. There was a case in Canada where some Psi researchers decided to invent an entity. And after putting some effort into it, putting some focus on it, the thing actually seemed to exist. And started.
Yeah, that's the Philip experiment.
That was a what?
That's the Philip experiment.
Okay, all right.
That's covered in my Tulpa book.
Okay, good. Because that's what always comes to mind at those points.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah, it's a result of, you know, the Philip experiment is fascinating and, you know, possibly a result of collective consciousness, but these people, you know, focusing on this, the creation of this entity and putting so much energy into it that it starts to manifest in different ways.
And I often wonder if that's what happens at some ghost cases where they're in an area that feels weird, that maybe has some weird energy, and they start digging around, oh, this person died, so it must be this person, and the energy starts taking on the appearance of that particular person.
Well, I absolutely believe that, and it's funny. I mean, we're way into the territory of my new book on tulpas now, but, you know, one of the things I cover in this coming book is the idea that some of the most famous haunted sites, you know, have a very different history than you may realize. And the best example that comes to mind at the moment for that is the Myrtles Plantation. Now, the Myrtles Plantation is reported to be one of the most haunted sites in the country. And, you know, literally thousands of people go there every year. A lot of them hoping to see a ghost. They go on the ghost tours. They, you know, they do investigations and so forth. And it's a great location. It's a beautiful house. It's an amazing spot. There's a lot of strange activity there. The most well-known spirit that purportedly is there is the ghost of a slave named Chloe. Now, there's a really famous picture. To my knowledge, it has not been debunked, but there's a very famous picture of Chloe that was taken. It appears to be a woman in an old-fashioned dress with a turban on her head, appearing between the main house and the secondary house in this alley, and it's an incredible photograph. Now, here's the thing: Chloe never existed. The entire story of Chloe, which involves her being a slave who is having an affair with the master of the house, her ear is cut off because she gets caught eavesdropping, hence she wears a turban to cover that. She later poisons the children of the home in order to, hopefully heal them so that she can be back in favor again. But she uses too much, and as a result, the kids die. And, as a result of that, of course, she's caught and taken care of. But the thing is that still to this day, I've been to the Myrtles a lot of times, and people in droves come, and they hear the ghost tales on the tour of Chloe, and they hear these reports of her apparition, and they wander around the property with cameras and EVP recorders hoping to catch evidence of Chloe. You know, thousands of people believe that Chloe is there. There's no historical evidence to support that whatsoever. The children, in fact, were not poisoned. The historical record says they died of yellow fever. So, we have this entire myth that was created, but yet we have years worth of people going there seeking out this particular spirit. And guess what? They're catching evidence. People have caught EVPs they believe were Chloe. They have caught photographs of apparitions and other strange things. And, people go to the location and they have interactions with Chloe. So what exactly is going on? Are we seeing the creation of a tulpa from so many people focusing on the idea of this person existing? Or are we seeing some other entity is merely utilizing that focus in order to help themselves manifest? It's difficult to say.
Yeah. All right, well, let's get back to the current book, Strange Intruders. Let's move on to the Shadow People. And what was kind of interesting is that there's a movie out called Shadow People, I think it is, a B-movie that was released independently and stuff. And I happened to come across it, and I watched it, and I can't say I thought that much of it. But the funny thing is, as I got done with it, I picked up your book to read the next chapter, and it was on Shadow People.
Yeah, one of those synchronicities, huh?
Yeah. And,
people have been talking about shadow beings for a long, long time in the paranormal. And essentially, it's what appears to be a humanoid form that is apparently completely made of shadow. In other words, it's just a black form. It looks like a person's shadow, but it moves independently. And there's a lot of controversy and a lot of different opinions as to what exactly these things are. Some people believe they're manifesting from some other dimension and intruding into our world. Some people perceive that possibly the shadow people are just a manifestation of another entity, perhaps the jinn, for instance. That's a very common theory now. Some type of spiritual being that is utilizing that form in order to manifest. For the most part, these encounters tend to be more on the frightening side. They tend to harass people and try to cause harm or at the least disrupt the person's daily life when they manifest. The accounts seem to stay pretty steady as far as I can see over the last 10 years or so. There's constantly a good number of these encounters that are being reported. And there's even some famous haunted locations now that purport to have these things manifest on a regular basis too. So, again, it could be that we're seeing something utilizing the form and the idea. This is something else that a lot of investigators, professional and amateur, go and seek out. You know, they're trying to catch the shadow people, you know, catch them on film or catch evidence of them.
Right, right. And the movie seemed to get grasp some of that. I think what bugged me about the movie is they were trying to make it into not really a found footage, but like that they were reenacting something that really happened, and they were doing kind of a fourth kind type of thing that Mila Jovovich was in, where they were showing footage that
right.
wasn't real, but portraying it as if it was, like that they were interviewing real people. And I don't know. That genre, I think, has run its course quite a bit for the most part.
I don't think we've seen the end of it yet, though.
No. And sometimes it's done really well. But, you know, this was it, maybe if this had a better budget and, you know, it was almost a Freddy Krueger thing. They fall asleep and the shadow people would kill them.
Right.
You know, they obviously took at least some of it from actual encounters with shadow people. They just made it a little more dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I personally have experienced a great deal of is shadow beings of all kinds.
Interesting.
And one of the things you talk about in the book is that people who are involved with the occult tend to start seeing them.
Yeah, that's very common.
And I would say that's pretty much, you know, I used to, well, still have some ceremonial magic background, and that's kind of when I started experiencing them as well. So there's definitely a connection there.
Right.
It's just a matter of what it is and what they are.
Yeah, it's very common for people who are involved with either some type of ceremonial magic or witchcraft to start seeing manifestations of these things. The other thing that happens is that I've seen a lot of people who start experiencing these things, and it will turn out that the location, the home they're living in, was formerly the site of a lot of that type of activity. So it's as if it builds a pool of residual energy, or possibly it opens some kind of a gateway to something that, you know, those practitioners really weren't fully aware of what they were doing.
Right. And you have a few stories in the book talking about stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Sure do, yeah.
Now, you start off the book actually talking about the djinn, and they seem to be a growing interest to people. And it seems like a lot of people hadn't even heard of them more than a few years ago.
Yeah, and it's curious because I think I get more questions now about the djinn than I do anything else. And this is actually, you know, a very popular area of interest now, as you say. In the West, you know, most people are conditioned to think about these things as being something rather silly. You know, the westernized term is genie, and that automatically brings to mind for most people either, you know, like a Disney cartoon, or if you're a little bit older, you know, maybe the, you know, I Dream a Genie silly girl right. in the harem pants screwing up all of her magic. And that's a very dangerous way to approach these things, because these figures are much more sinister than that. They go back to early creation myths, essentially, in the Middle East. And in the ancient Islamic traditions, you know, the jinn were created at the same time that angels and humans were created. What happened was that Allah created the jinn out of something called a smokeless flame, or a smokeless fire. And the jinn were ordered to bow down to the superiority of man. When they refused to do so, they were banished. So we sort of see a similarity between, you know, this whole storyline and, you know, the biblical idea of a revolt where, you know, a portion of the angels are cast down. Right. The difference is that the jinn, they're banished, but they essentially still exist all around us. And, you know, when you go to a lot of other regions of the world, the Middle East, any parts of Asia, you'll find this concept that the jinn can live in virtually anything. They can live in abandoned buildings. They can live in, you know, in the wind. There are famous sites such as Petra that are purportedly, you know, just filled with jinn. And then you hear this other concept that they can also live in objects. Now, the evolution of this that goes down into the medieval and the Renaissance and medieval periods, both, you find that there's a lot of ceremonial magic, again, that is directed towards capturing and controlling jinn. So this is really where this concept of a genie in a bottle came from. We had ancient mystics who were fascinated with the idea of capturing a jinn and attaching it to usually a piece of jewelry, a ring, a necklace, a bracelet, and the idea was that jinn was held there and could be commanded to do whatever the magician needed it to do. So over the years, a lot of these types of artifacts were created and, of course, sold to the wealthy and passed around and so forth. And the evolution is that, you know, in the Middle East now, obviously because of all the conflicts, a lot of Western soldiers who are in the Middle East. And I have spoken to so many of these people that have brought back objects. They've brought these objects home. And, you know, sometimes they find them, sometimes they purchase them. They'll purchase an object in a market, and they're told, oh, yeah, this ring holds powerful jinn. And, you know, to these soldiers, most of the time, that's kind of cool, you know. Well, that's funny, you know. Yeah, this thing's got a, this necklace has got a genie in it. I'm going to give it to my wife. And, you know, often what happens is that these people get these objects home and find that a lot of strange activity begins to manifest around them. Poltergeist-like activity, illnesses, and just a wide range of other difficulties. These jinn are very trickster-like in that they usually will try to start communicating with a person and portray themselves as a helpful spirit. And the whole point is to get the unwitting victim under control and lead them down a very dark path.
And, yeah, I noticed the poltergeist connection was pretty strong in these cases. And, again, we got to wonder if it's just a different face on the same phenomena.
It very well could be. You know, my friend Rosemary Guiley has done a lot of research on the jinn, and you know, a lot of her research has pointed to the idea that the jinn are really responsible for a lot of things, like shadow people, you know, alien encounters, and so forth. One of the things you find in traditional jinn mythos is that they are able to assume many different forms, manifest in a lot of different ways. You know, I've had cases where people were, you know, believe they were in contact with their deceased father, for instance, or, you know, another deceased loved one, and they were getting information from this person. And as things progressed, the information would be accurate, but the things that would start to happen to this person would be very negative. You know, they would lose jobs and relationships, and health would fail, and things like this. At this point, they had become so dependent on receiving that, quote, spiritual guidance that they were very confused as to why things were going so badly. And a lot of these cases have been traced back to, again, cursed objects, you know, things that came from the Middle East that purportedly had a jinn attached to them.
Hmm. Why do you think they're so specifically connected with the Middle East?
Well, you know, the whole tradition of the jinn came out of Islam, and I think that's how it spread so far. I think we're seeing so much from the Middle East now, just because, you know, what are we 10 years or more into, you know, essentially war in those countries that involve Western powers. So, you know, a large number of people have done tours of duty over there at this point, and they've come back to, you know, America, the UK, and so forth, and they're bringing back, you know, these entities, whatever they are. You know, and jinn is just a label like a lot of things are. All we know is that we're dealing with some type of very powerful entity that does not have our best interest at heart.
One of the things you talk about in this book that I had not heard of before are the Pukwudgies.
Oh, yes.
Which is a fascinating name to start off with. And this is more Native American, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's it's really specific to the Northeast. And the Pukwudgies, first of all, they are little people, essentially. So, you know, and a lot of times when you say, you know, little people or wee folk, most people think about the typical, you know, Celtic fairy world, little leprechauns and gnomes and so forth that you find in the Celtic lands and Scandinavia. A lot of people don't realize that there are actually legends of little people all over the world. You know, Hawaii has a whole race of them called the Menahune. When you come to North America, you'll find that a lot of tribes, from the Cherokee to the Utes, you know, they have these legends of these little people. And, you know, there's always different sets of tales that essentially are very similar to what we find in the Celtic tradition. The Pukwudgies, however, are a little bit different. And what's different about them is that in the creation stories of that region, you'll find that there's a cultural hero named Mashop. And what happens is that the Pukwudgies are these troublesome creatures that begin to, you know, harass the natives, and they'll do all kinds of things. They'll try to lure them into the woods. They'll steal things from them. Very troublesome creatures that become worse as the tales go on, to the point that the natives finally call out to their hero, Mashop, to deal with the Pukwudgies. So Mashop is this giant that comes along. He fights the Pukwudgies, and he essentially picks them up and throws them to all directions, you know, to get rid of them. And for a time, everything's peaceful. These little people are not, they're not showing up. They're leaving the villagers alone. They appear to be gone. But slowly, they are all coming back. And they go on a campaign, really, of terror. And they start leading villagers to their deaths. And, you know, they become more than just trickster-like beings. They go to a much more sinister place. And, again, Mashop comes in order to deal with them. And when he comes to confront the Pukwudgies this time, he actually loses the fight. And depending on which version of the tales you hear, he either just disappears or he is killed by the Pukwudgies. So, you know, this is a rare thing to see the native cultural hero defeated by this evil force. And the result is that these things still apparently exist in the region. And so much to the point that, you know, people now report seeing these things. There's areas all around Massachusetts that are, you know, known for manifestations of Pukwudgies. They've been seen as far away as Indiana. But mostly it's in that Massachusetts region. Fremont State Park is a hotspot for them. And you'll hear these stories of people, you know, spotting these little creatures. Sometimes they're described as being little, Elmo-like creatures, I think, is what Fiona Broom, a paranormal investigator, described them as. Other people describe them as these little 3 or 4 foot, two or 3 foot tall creatures that look very, very rough, with a lot of tree pieces and leaves and things like that, natural materials to use as clothing. They have sort of a sinister air about them, and most of the people that see them seem to you know, really be afraid of them and just get away from them as quickly as they can.
Huh. See, you're on WVBR FM Ithaca. You're listening to Where'd the Road Go? We're talking with David Weatherly about his new book, Strange Intruders. And we're almost out of time, but I wanted to bring up, as you were talking about these things, you relate a bunch of other stories and legends from other Indian tribes around the country. One of the things I found interesting is that some of these stories match up with David Politis's work, with missing 411 as far as where people are taken and where these things live. I'm not sure how familiar you are with his work, but he talks about like fields and things like that are where people are often found or where they disappear. And this is where these creatures, you know, according to Native Americans, exist. And I thought that was a really interesting connection.
Yeah, he's done some fascinating work. He really has. One of the things you'll find that's very different in North America, of course, is that if you go to a lot of Europe, for instance, Ireland, you know, which has a very solid tradition of the wee folk, you'll find that areas that people say are, you know, there's a fairy mound there, and the wee people live in that space. It's left alone. You know, they don't go in and pave over it. They don't slap a road there. They'll actually, you know, take a road in a different direction to go around a fairy mound.
Right.
We don't see that kind of respect for these locations in the United States. It's just an inconvenience because it's superstition and so forth. So, you know, we've had a lot of areas in this country where, you know, humans have intruded into areas that the natives always considered taboo, or, you know, places that should be left alone. And, you know, it's forced this interaction to occur between humans and whatever this unknown force is. And, you know, I find it fascinating. I'm very intrigued by these portal areas, you know, areas of just an incredible amount of high strangeness, where you'll see everything from UFO sightings to, you know, reptilian encounters and haunted sites and everything else. And, right. You know, that's sort of what we get into the territory of there. You know, you find these places where the natives will talk about the little people living there, or, you know, some other race of beings living there. And in this country, for the most part, we don't really seem to care about that. If Walmart wants to put in a new store there, they're going to find a way to do it. And, you know, they don't care if there's a fairy mound there or whatever it is.
Well, it may lead to people disappearing at that.
Very possibly. David's work is fascinating. I mean, there's so much that can be addressed there, because the number of disappearances in this country is phenomenal. And most people don't realize that.
Literally
thousands of people a day go missing.
And we had him on a couple of weeks ago, and I mean, after reading through all his research, to me, portals seem like the most likely explanation, whether something is coming through and taking people, or people are wandering through on accident and not knowing how to get back.
Right, exactly.
So when you work on this type of stuff, do people find you, or do you have to go out and seek out stories, or is it a little bit of both?
You know, some of both. When I started in the field, you know, back in the 70s, it took a lot of hard work to go find this stuff, because you had to, you know, develop some communication. You know, you had to really work your way around into the weirder aspects of things, because it wasn't as acceptable back then. And slowly over the years, that has transformed to the point that it is now. You know, I always joke and say, you know, when I started in this field, if I walked in a party and said, yeah, I'm a paranormal investigator, I was guaranteed to spend the rest of the night by myself, you know, because everybody said, oh, you know, that guy, don't go over there. But now if I walk to the party and say that, you know, they're lined up out the door, because everybody's got an experience to share. So, you know, I'm kind of glad it's developed the way it has. It's still a lot of work, because, as we were talking about earlier, now you have to cut through, you know, what's mistaken, you know, identity, what's a possible hoax, something else. So, you know, it's still just as much work, but, you know, I find that, a lot of people seek me out, and, you know, I still go out, and I spend a lot of time actually investigating, going into areas and talking to people and communicating with people. But I still find that the sort of cream of the crop tends to be people that you go out and find yourself as an investigator. You know, the ones that, have extra pieces that they haven't really talked about, you know, to the whole paranormal puzzle. So it's still exciting.
I think the internet has probably been a blessing and a curse to the field, because with the internet comes technology to like easily hoax stuff. Anyone can put up a hoax, but at the same time, it lets legitimate stories get around bit easier. And yeah, I think same with the paranormal TV shows. I mean, whether you like them or not, they have made the subjects a little more accessible and taken away some of the stigma from them that used to exist.
Yeah, they certainly have.
So, all right. Well, your book, Strange Intruders, is available currently where?
LeprechaunPress.com.
Okay, and it will be on Amazon eventually.
Yeah, eventually it will. And you can find my work at twocrowsparanormal.blogspot.com. And like I said, there's all the relevant links on there. So,
okay.
Yeah, feel free to follow along. And I make a lot of convention appearances. I'm at the Paradigm Symposium that we talked about earlier in the middle of October. I'll be speaking in L.A. in November, and lots of other exciting things coming up.
All right. And when do you plan on publishing the next book on the tulpas?
Tulpas hopefully will be out by the end of this year.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so very much, David, for making some time for us to talk about this. And, I look forward to the next book.
Yeah, always a pleasure, Soraya. Thanks.
All right, and we're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation. The Last Exit for the Lost is up next.
Shut the closet door, it's under the floor. The monster's there. Don't leave me here among these ghosts. You promised me nightmares the day I was born. Promised me hellfire, you were so sure. I grew up waiting for demons to find me. I grew up hungry for ghosts to define me. Give me the nightmares, cause death doesn't scare me. I want the vampires and I want the glory. Suffering, offering doom, 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 doom. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chew me, slake me, thrill me. I don't want the unicorn, I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform, cause I'm a monster. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. This is a sound I've heard before. It's like a voice asking for more. Rachel, a clot, a cause, this error. Home from sector to primavera. Give me the nightmares, cause death doesn't scare me. I want